gave me the biggest aha experience I had since I first came across marginal utility, which is saying a lot. I think you'll find the ideas in this book very provocative. They're quite different from what passes for economic wisdom out of Washington. You know, the discussions about which group of irresponsible, which irresponsible institution is going to be able to get its money from the public trough to continue surviving, quite different from free markets. Maybe it's time to let the biggest bank robbers in history quit running institutions that they've wrecked. Please join me in welcoming John.
Thank you, Daniel. I'd like to say how happy I am to be here at the Google headquarters. This is always the second time I've been here. It's always exciting for me. I just love this place. I'd like to thank Daniel for inviting me and y'all for coming. I have to say that this is a new experience for me because when I speak, I normally take out my speech and flat-footed I give the speech. But I, since I've come to the epicenter of technology here, I decided to do a PowerPoint presentation, actually an open office impress presentation, because we don't want to send our money to the wrong places. But also, I like to keep up with technology, you know, at least within a 20-year window. But today I'm here to talk about my book, Toward a Truly Free Market, A Distributist Perspective. Of course, first time I'm using technology, of course, naturally it runs into a big problem. The machine freezes up just as we plug it in. But, of course, at the center of technology, we can fix those things. Well, then, today I'd like to talk about three questions. The first is, what is a free market? And the second is, what is distributism? And finally, what can we do about our current problems? Now, what is a free market? Something very surprising about this. If you go through standard economic textbooks, you'll find that they're not actually defined. They just sort of assume that everybody knows what that means. There is, however, a kind of implied definition. And that implied definition is a free market is one that's free from government regulation. Now, the odd thing about this definition is that it's a negative definition. All right, it doesn't really tell you what it is. It indicates the absence of something, not the presence of something. Now, it does allow for a function of government, and the sole function of government would be to protect private property. All right. So, this indicates that if left to itself, the market will take care of itself, and it needs nothing else outside of its own internal laws. Let's test that definition. Let's look at this sterling gentleman, Jay Gould. Jay Gould was a businessman during the days of the robber barons of the 19th century. And Mr. Gould controlled all of the railroads that went into New York City. And he decided to use this control of the railroads to establish for himself a monopoly in building supplies. And how did he do this? He refused to let his railroad carry any competitive products. If you were a manufacturer of building supplies, you couldn't put them on Jay Gould's railroad, which means you couldn't get them to the city of New York. Now, this ended with the imposition, when Congress imposed the common carrier rule on railroads. Common carrier rule means that if you offer to carry freight, you must carry all freight on an equal basis and not discriminate against anybody. So, question, where is freedom in this case? Does it lie with unrestricted private property? Under that system, the owner can say, let's say you're a producer of Pennsylvania Bluestone, Jay Gould can say to you, I will not carry your products unless you first sell them to me at a price and quantity that I dictate. Or is freedom with the common carrier rule, which states that you must carry all freight that's presented to you. From Mr. Gould's standpoint, well, unrestricted private property equals the freedom of the market. But from the producer's standpoint, it equals tyranny. It equals somebody else telling him what he has to make, how much he has to make, and what he's going to make. And for buyers and sellers in the market, clearly the common carrier rule equals market freedom. And without that common carrier rule, there is no market freedom. There's just a bunch of corporate warlords. So, before we can understand a free market, we have to understand freedom. And what is freedom? It's the rule of reason. In other words, freedom has an object. It's not license. It's not just the absence of any restraint. It's actually directed toward reason. And markets are, in fact, made by rules. You know, without rules, without limits, the invisible hand of the market becomes the visible fist, crushing all opposition, as in the case of Jay Gould. In fact, all human relationships are rule-bound. Make an analogy to the internet. You know, somebody's not following the protocols, the whole thing locks up. In order to have the freedom of the internet, you have to have a set of rules. And so, or else this whole marvelous structure falls apart. Think about a football game. If there's not a regulator, whom we call the referee, out there to throw the yellow flag when somebody grabs a face mask, nobody's going to step on the field. The mortality rates would simply be too high. But rules can be reasonable or oppressive. And so rules themselves need a rule. So what makes a rule reasonable? Well, within the economic realm, economic reason equals justice. Justice means each person gets what is due to them. Now, there's two forms of justice. The first is justice in exchange, which we call commutative or corrective justice. And the second is justice in production, which we call distributive justice. Let's deal with commutative justice. Commutative justice deals with a change of ownership in existing things. So when you buy bread for money, you're changing the ownership of two already existing things. And justice in that case consists in equality in exchange. So we presume that A and B, after the exchange, have an equal amount, just in different forms. If you bread is a dollar, a loaf of bread is a dollar, after the exchange, the seller has a dollar and you have the loaf of bread, but in terms of wealth, you both have the same amount. Now, in a free commodity market, we generally assume that equality is expressed by the price. This is also called arithmetic justice, because it can, in principle, be calculated. We should note, however, that market pricing doesn't work in monopolistic, oligopolistic, or controlled markets. The price may not be reflective of the true value. Let's go to distributive justice, though. But this applies to the production of new things. Okay, where commutative justice cannot solve the problems of distribution. So when we take a tree and make some chairs, we've called something new into being, something that wasn't there before. All right? How do we distribute these new things? Who gets them? Well, the rule of justice here is based on contributions to the production, quite obviously. Those who contributed to the production of the new chairs ought to get a fair share of the new chairs. And also, nobody else, people who did not contribute to the production, ought not to have a claim on that production. Okay. But we also have to take into account the merit of the contribution. So some person's a carpenter, and another person's the janitor. Now, we evaluate those contributions differently. And that's the merit of the contribution. The thing about merit of the contribution, though, is that it cannot be calculated, even in principle. You have to make a judgment. Now, Aristotle pointed out that this judgment on the relative merit of contributions will vary from culture to culture. So how do we value the different inputs to a product from the product engineer? Yes, sir. No, that's a contribution to production. That is a contribution to production. Of course, you have to understand the owner of the tree. The tree is made available only by labor. The tree in the forest isn't very useful to anybody. It has to be cut down. It has to be transported, etc. Okay. So in evaluating the various roles, engineer, marketing, the janitor, the production line worker, etc. Aristotle pointed out that aristocratic civil societies will evaluate those contributions one way, oligarchic societies another way, democratic societies another way. But the point there is that you really don't have a calculation. You have a cultural judgment. All right, let's skip forward to our own cultural moment, the current problem. We are obviously in the midst of some very difficult times, more difficult for some of us than for others. But it is worth noting that 90% of all economists missed the coming of this disaster. And those who pointed out what was coming were marginalized and ridiculed, you know, called Dr. Dooms and Cassandras, all right? Oh, I think it's pretty accepted. Actually, 90% is a very optimistic rating because there weren't a handful of economists, and I've seen surveys of the literature that make the 90% number, in fact, very optimistic. Okay, but the same was true of the last disaster and the one before that and the one before that and the one before that. And the one before that. And the one before that. The truth is, if your doctor had the same track record as your economist, you'd be dead by now. Something is missing in economic science. It is an incomplete science. In its present state, it cannot actually describe the workings of any actual economy. Hence, it cannot be predictive. You can't predict the course of a system that you can't describe. And finally, it is not prescriptive. If you cannot prescribe a remedy if you cannot predict the course of the disease. So what is missing? From Aristotle to Adam Smith, economics was a colony of ethics. And no philosopher or theologian worth his stipend was without his political and economic commentary. But it was always a political economy. It always embedded in a system of laws, of customs, of political institutions, of social expectations. And nobody ever looked at it apart from these things. But the 19th century political economists were embarrassed by this connection with justice. Why? They wanted to be a real science. Okay. Or as one commentator put it, they suffered from physics envy. What? Real science, they felt, dealt only with pure number and objective measurement, you know? This is empiricism, typified by, say, the Chicago schools. Or else, on the other side, it dealt only with pure theory, abstract reasoning from secure axioms, you know? This is the idealism of the Austrian school. All right. But whatever, it must be split from politics, culture, values, society. Everything must stand on its own, which meant, of course, it must be self-regulating. Obviously, if you have no connection with the political process or the social environment or the culture or anything else, then you must assume the market is self-regulating. All right, what are the results of that? For you have the myth of the self-regulating market, one of the prime factors in creating this current situation. You had the divorce of justice and economics. Right? Those were value-laden questions. You had the divorce of the political and economic order, and hence a loss of any real understanding of both orders. Okay? You cannot understand the political order without understanding its economic base. And a description of a political order without that economic base simply doesn't describe anything. At the same time, the economic order is always inscribed within a political order. And again, you cannot understand it as something separate and apart because it doesn't exist that way. Hence, what we had is a substitution of ideology for real science. And that is indeed what happens in the economic realm. Their disputes can never be resolved because they have no standard of truth by which to arbitrate between the various schools. However, the most important thing to ask is, does the theory work? So I have a very busy chart up here. And I'm reading charts, actually, before you read any of the actual text. It's good to read just to get the lay of the land, the graphics. You'll notice up here that on this side of the chart, you see a lot of gray bands. And on this side of the chart is mainly white. You see this red line, how erratic it is at the beginning here, and how much smoother it is toward the end. And this blue line, how flat it is on the first part, and then what a steep slope it has, an exponential slope there at the end. Well, those gray bands are recessions and depressions. That red line is the change in GDP, the quarterly change in GDP. And that blue line is the growth of the economy in absolute terms. Notice here, this period here is a period of pure free market ideology, or as nearly as pure as you can get it. And in that period, 1900 to 1946, there were 12 contractions. These 12 contractions occurred almost every 4 years, lasted 18 months, and had an average decline in GDP approaching 7%. Now, since that time, we've had 11 contractions, including the current one. They occur much less frequently, every 6 years, They last almost half as long, 10 months, and the average decline is 1.5%. So obviously there was something wrong with this free market ideology, and that's why people abandoned it. Because in this period, from 1853 to 1943, you had, we were in recession or depression 40% of the time. 40%. Since then, we've been in recession, even concurring including the current recession, 15% of the time. So which economy would you rather live in? Yes, sir. Except,
yeah. The country became a superpower, could export more freely, the dollar became a common monetary instrument. So, regardless of.
Except the same thing happened in England when it was a superpower. Matter of fact, England's economy was more, as it was a superpower, was more unstable than the United States is. Yeah. So it has to be something more than the super, although the superpower status certainly affects it, has to be something more than a superpower status at work. But in any case, the free market, both in England and the United States, suffered from a chronic failure of demand. As I've said, it was in recession 40% of the time. Now, it's, since then, it's been in recession 15% of the time. Why? What stabilized the economy? The wrong thing. Government became the big spender in the middle that balanced supply and demand. All right? Before the New Deal, government, the federal government budget was maybe 2 to 4% of GDP. Since the New Deal, it's varied from between 18 and 42% of GDP. That's quite a change. So the free market ideology led to a big state reality. And not just here, everywhere. There are no historical exceptions to this. It was true for every state. Every advanced state is statist. Okay? Of course, the question now is, will this continue? Have we kind of played this game out? Well, let's talk about how we get there. Okay, here's where my computer skills get really crude. So, oh no, this is the next slide. Okay, talk about justice and economics here. Without distributive justice, equity, the economy cannot reach equilibrium that is by itself. It needs some non-economic help. Now, by equilibrium, I mean that rough balance between supply and demand, without which people will not, without the expectation of equilibrium, people will not bring goods to market. Okay? So equilibrium depends on equity, on justice, as a purely practical matter. Never mind the moral arguments. As a purely practical matter, you've got to have some degree of equity in the economy. And I would argue that equity and equilibrium are almost the same words and practically the same thing. Let's see how that actually works. Here's where you have to cut me some slack. My computer skills on drawing charts here are a little bit crude, but okay. This line represents rising productivity, which is sort of a natural thing. Technology improves, people get more skillful, et cetera, et cetera. All right, and so in our economy, through most of our history, we've had rising productivity. And at the same time, we more or less had rising wages. As productivity improved, wages improved. Okay, not always easily, sometimes industrial action, sometimes a lot of social discord, but in general, at the end of any 10 or 15 year period, productivity and wages came into line. Then came the year 1973. And a funny thing happened. Productivity exploded. in all categories of labor. Okay? Wages flatlined. The median wage, the white male worker, is the same today as it was in 1973, and it never moved up or down very much. As a matter of fact, it's $800 lower today. Well, what was the response to this? The first response was putting more family members to work. That generally meant that women entered the labor market, okay? In 1973, the median family was a one-income family. A couple of decades later, it was a two-income family. Yes, sir? Yeah. But that's the problem of addressing the cultural and economic issues, you see. It's not so much a matter of cause and effect. It's a matter of things that happen that reinforce each other. So a trend towards women's liberation is also reinforced by the fact that it's becoming more and more difficult to absorb the goods and services on one-income families. It really is a mistake to separate the issues. You never get a full picture. However, since 1998, the family wage has flatlined, the median wage. So families working as hard as they ever did, but they haven't received their pay has not kept up with the increase in goods and services. How did we absorb the output? Consumer credit. The people with money lent it to the people, to the mass of people, usually at interest rates of somewhere around 30%, to absorb the excess goods and services. All right. This also led to the investor's dilemma. Okay? The worker gets too little, therefore the consumer markets are undersupplied. The investor gets too much. That is, capital markets are oversupplied. But this is contradictory, because when you narrow the consumer market, you also narrow true investment opportunities, which depend on the number of solvent consumers in the market. So what happened? The investor turns to speculative instruments. These are the CDOs, the MBSs, the CDSs, the synthetic CDOs, CDOs cubed, that sort of thing, which were pure finance instruments. They didn't actually aid production, which is what finance is supposed to do. So the investor got all that he wanted, only to find that that's not what he wanted at all. So I think here we have the conundrum of capitalism, expressed by G.K. Chesterton. Capitalism is contradictory as soon as it is complete, because it is dealing with the mass of men in two opposite ways at once. When most men are wage earners, it is more and more difficult for most men to be customers. For the capitalist is always trying to cut down what his servant demands. And in doing so, he is cutting down what his customer can spend. He is wanting the same man to be rich and poor at the same time. So, what is distributism? Distributism is theory of the political economy, which deals with the crucial role of distributive justice, which is precisely the kind of justice that the political economy, that the new economists cut out of economics when they invented their new science of economics. Why? Because it can't be calculated. It can only be judged. You can make a reasonable judgment, but you can't make a calculation. In their minds, that meant it wasn't a science. For the distributists, that's the only thing that can make it scientific. So it is a political economy. It assumes a political framework and takes that political social framework into account. And as a political economy, it measures success of the economy by the support it gives to families, community, small business, small farmers, etc. GDP or GNP is an insufficient measurement of the economy. As a matter of fact, it's deceptive because it may actually be a measure of decline. Take this example. Society is collapsing, leading to an increase in crime, all right? Which means we build more prisons, okay? The prisons show up as an increase in GDP, but is it really an increase or is it just an increase in costs? GDP treats negative expenditures as additions to productivity. All right. I'd like to deal here with equity in two kinds. Equity in rewards, the pay, and even under standard economic theory, for the theory to work, returns to labor and capital have to be normalized to each other. That is, neither by working nor by investing could you earn very much more than one or the other. They're sort of normalized to each other. They're within a reasonable range. Okay, as I say, that's a requirement of the standard theory. There's also equity in property. And by property, I mean land or tools or skills. You know, these are all acquired as a property. Now, equity in property is very interesting. Large concentrations of property distort the market. You get monopolies, oligarchies, cartels. They also distort the political process. You get subsidies, tax breaks, bailouts, privileges. And they are economically inefficient. It's very funny. Friedrich Hayek has this wonderful critique of socialism, and he shows point by point why socialism doesn't work. But if you look internal to a large multi-divisional corporation, you'll find that Hayek's critiques apply point by point internal to the corporation. The major reason, there's many reasons, but the major reason I'll point out here is because you have a large group selling to each other, one division selling to each other, each division using corporate services. There's no market. There's no way to price them. Yes, sir. I don't know, because I really don't know enough, one, about the advertising market, which is really what Google is in. And two, I think we're a little bit early in the stage of the computer market to understand how this is going to play out. It's definitely a special case, but I mean, it's a good question. I don't have the right answer to it. But I would also say that these things are, they're economically inefficient, but they're very politically efficient. That is, they learn how to control governments. They learn how to externalize costs. They learn how to get subsidies. But they also violate the vast number of firms hypothesis. In the standard theory, every commodity has to be, for it to work, every commodity is supplied by a vast number of firms such that no firm has any pricing power in the market. They're all price takers rather than price makers. That's not true when ownership is concentrated. And they display small businesses. Walmart moves into a community, all the small shops close. So there's less opportunity for people to become their own masters, as it were. All right. Well-distributed property, then. Property distributes economic freedom. And a person with their own property, land, tools, skills, is always in a much better bargaining position and always has the option of going out on his own. Distributes political power. I mean, I think it's useless to talk about democracy when all the money's in one place. Having spent my misspent youth as a politician, and been elected to office 5 times, I understand the relationship between money and politics. It improves the wage, because when wage is a negotiation. People who have alternatives are in a better position to negotiate. It's economically efficient. It fulfills the vast number of firms hypothesis, and it requires less government. When there's a better distribution of rewards, when people are more self-reliant, they are less dependent upon the state. Yes, sir? That's an excellent question. Would you hold it to the end? Because I have an example of just that that addresses that. Excellent question, though. Okay. People are more self-sufficient, therefore they're less dependent upon the government. Now, as soon as you talk about a better distribution of property, the first thing that pops into a lot of minds is socialism! No, there you go. There's a fear of taking property from some and giving it to others. But let me suggest, and indeed there are extreme cases where that's necessary. Let's not be shy about this. To take one example, Taiwan's land to the tiller program, where they took the land from 20 families and gave it to nearly 500,000 families. All right. And that led to such an expansion of agriculture, because it turns out people work their own land better than they work the master's land. That's just the way it is. That was the basis of that island's remarkable movement from a feudal backwater to an industrial powerhouse in just one generation. Same thing was, by the way, generally true among the so-called Asian tigers. There's another extreme case that worked the opposite, the TARP program. These companies were bankrupt, and instead of buying them up and distributing them to regional banks, we gave them a lot of money. We did the opposite. The five biggest banks before this crash are now even bigger. So, it turns out, I think, that distributing property is not about what government does, but about what it should stop doing. Because government, it turns out, is the biggest factor in property accumulation. There's some forms of property accumulation which would not even be possible without a legal form and a government to support it, such as the limited liability corporation. Now, all of this may sound good to you, may sound bad, doesn't matter. When people are talking abstract principles of economics or anything else dealing with humans, be very, very careful. Believe only what you can see on the ground and working. Whoop. How did we get there? Okay. So let me talk about some real live examples. First is the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation of Spain. This is a 60-year-old collection of cooperatives. There are 80,000 worker owners, and they do 25 billion per annum in sales. And they do everything from hunting smoothbore hunting pieces to electronic factories built to order. They do finance, and they do retail, mass retail. 60-year history. What's interesting about Mondragon is that from its own resources, they built a school system, training institutes, a social safety network, R&D facilities, even their own university, all without government help. Oddly enough, it's the nearest thing to a working libertarian system that we have in captivity. Another example. Believe what you can see. This is in Emilia-Romagna, which is the area around Bologna in Spain, and they have a 125-year history of worker cooperatives. And in fact, 35 to 40% of their GDP comes from worker cooperatives. They also have a different model from Mondragon. Mondragon is, looks, its organization chart would look like a typical corporation. But in Emilia-Romagna, they have a networked organization. As a matter of fact, I think it's more kind of like a, it's more something more in tune with those who work with the internet would understand, because when they cooperate on big jobs, they join temporary alliances among these all of these small companies to work on big jobs, arbitrarily big jobs. And when that job, that order is over, then they form different alliances to do different things. So it's interesting that the average wage in Emilia-Romagna is twice the average in Italy. Okay. And they have their standard of living is among the highest in Europe. Okay, believe what you can see. And I think historically, distributism goes from success to success, while capitalism goes from bailout to bailout. All right, there's other examples, ESOPs, cooperatives, mutual banks, insurance companies. Could do this one all day. There we go. All right. So that brings me to the book, and my publisher said I had to push the book. Okay. Let me summarize some things. Man is both an individual and a social being. Current economic theories treat him either as a pure individual, okay, in which we get certain forms of libertarianism, not all of them, or as a pure social entity, which we get socialism and communism. Both are incorrect because they start with an incorrect understanding of man. Human freedom is both personal and social. Okay. Market freedom then provides the material base for both personal and social freedom. In other words, this market freedom is not just an abstract entity, it has a practical purpose. We want it for a reason. And it has both social and individual aspects. Okay? That's why merely taking an individual aspect, like Jay Gould's free use of his railroads, is not sufficient to supply a free market. Material freedom is rooted in distributed property of some kind or another. Political freedom works best with free, self-reliant people in strong communities. And these strong communities must have a strong economic base. Material and political freedom are necessary for market freedom. In the end, I think the task is to make political economy accessible to a wide audience. And that's why I wrote this book. My first book was a textbook, did very well, I was very proud of it, got very nice academic reviews, okay. But let's say textbooks tend to be assigned reading. But I did want to write something that was accessible to the general public, because I think without some knowledge of political economy, there's no way out of our current problems. And I wanted to apply it to our present problems. I wanted to apply it to the questions involving taxes or trade or deficits or that healthcare, since we've just had such a wonderful, you know, two-year fact-free debate. And I wanted to do this without the normal economic jargon that I think puts people off. I was talking to somebody yesterday. She said, you know, reading economics reminded her of reading Sartre's Nausea. In Sartre's Nausea, everything the protagonist touched, it kind of just melted away, and it the whole feeling made him nauseous. And she said, well, reading economics, everything is mushy in that same way, and it just made her nauseous. So I'm hoping to write a book that overcomes economic nausea. Okay, let me suggest something. There are no solutions to our current problems under the current institutional arrangements. I think we've played the string out. We have 15 million unemployed by the most optimistic estimate, the U3 estimate. We have 200,000 new workers that come on stream each month. There is no combination of industries that can conceivably grow under current institutional arrangements to absorb that workforce. Reform is mandatory. Collapse is optional. We will either have collapse and then reform, or we will have reform and avoid collapse. So the two options for reform. Dictatorship is always one. Okay, because there's always somebody with all the answers, or whether he has all the answers or not, he managed to get all the armies. Which is, in the world, that often equates to having all the answers. But I think the other option is property, a better understanding of property. By the way, a discussion that's almost disappeared from the textbooks. And that's all I have. I thank you all for coming.
Going back to my original question before, which is, how do you handle the case of things that can only either be manufactured at scale or for just generally non-commodity items?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's the beauty of the thing, is that there's not one form of ownership. There's not one form of organization. Okay, and it can be scaled to any size. That was my point in the Mondragon example. If you had, if it was an American corporation, that would be around 125th to 150th largest in the United States. So, I mean, it's scalable to any arbitrary size.
Is this more just encouraging the idea of employee-owned cooperatives in any particular business?
Remember, that's one of the options. That's one of the options. A lot of tech companies, and I think this may be true of Google, they gave employees a wonderful sense of ownership through stock options and through various management techniques, that people really felt that they owned the space they were working in. I've noted, by the way, that there's a company in Seattle that used to do that. The company will remain nameless. But now I think they've outsourced so much of their work, like the mailroom they sent to SCM, and the printing shop they sent to Xerox, and the food service they sent to some company. And now they mostly hire temps. And I think it shows up in their products. But what do I know? Except for that my computer from that company froze up this morning just when I needed it.
So I have a question. What happens if in the same market, mm-hmm. or the same society, with distributive portion and current capitalist mm-hmm. Entity, would that mean that... How do they coexist? Because the two examples you gave are from Europe. Mm-hmm. They have a different social, different heritage, I would mm-hmm. say.
Yes, yes.
I would give an example. I used to have a life insurance policy with a mutual life insurance. Mm-hmm. And they decided that it's not good for them any longer. So they gave me $200, and they said that now they're converting the mutual life insurance into a stock company, and it's no longer mutual. So you, how would you protect? Suppose this is actually better. The new form is better, but it has to. You can't switch everything at once. So it'll be a time when there'll be two systems in the same society. What will happen then?
Yes. Well, I mean, you've shown the examples in Europe, but I could have cited examples in the United States. One very good book on that I would recommend is Jack Stack's A Stake in the Outcome, about the Springfield Remanufacturing Company. And it's just a superb, those who are interested in the management questions, because this enlightens management as well, are advised to read that book. The problem you raised here of demutualization depends on the legal framework, because in a mutual, the policyholders are supposed to be the owner. Policyholders are supposed to be the owners. However, again, whether they have any real power depends on the charter and the legal framework involved. So, but there's still lots of good mutual insurance companies, like Northwest Mutual Life, for example, which has always been a mutual company. I think Mutual of Omaha is another, and they're very successful. Yeah. So as far as coexisting, they do coexist. Okay, but I think the law right now and the big canons of the law are on one side. However, that's going to change, because everything's going to change. The question is, you know, how much influence and in what direction will you affect the change?
I have a follow-up question.
Yes, sir.
I'm interested in human nature. There are some systems that are very nice in theory, but they fail because
Absolutely.
They're against human nature.
Absolutely.
Communism, for example.
Pardon?
Communism.
Yes. Or capitalism.
That's another. I will give stick with communism.
Okay. But your choice.
Now, suppose one of the things we hopefully is good with capitalism is if you have a very good idea and you happen to have a good lawyer on your side, you may become very successful because you really have the best idea, you have technology, you protect yourself, and you can become as successful as you wish unless you get taxed to death, but it's a separate thing. But you can become successful. It means that you accumulate wealth because you deserve to accumulate wealth because you did something new. Something better. Would that be possible at all under a distributive system?
Well, I'm sure, you know, yes, it is, because there are people who do it. However, it depends on what you mean by accumulating wealth. If you mean that one man should have $50 billion that he cannot possibly spend, Aristotle recommended in those cases... and Aristotle was no communist by any means. Aristotle recommended that a person that rich ought to be exiled as a danger to the body politic. And I only bring that up to say that this is not a new question. It has been discussed for a while. People ought to earn their contribution to production, whatever that contribution is. But when you find out that it's really a contribution protected by a government monopoly through patent, I'm not so sure then that the government then, in protecting the monopoly, doesn't have some rights to talk about the distribution. Now, if you want to get government out of it and say, government, we're not enforcing patent, then we'll see how much it accumulates, okay? But if the government's in it, you can't argue both ways. You can't argue government, defend my accumulation, and government, stay out of my accumulation. You got to choose one or the other. Okay. Well, you're very kind and you're very patient. And I do thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.